YUN interview with Larry Finkelstein on November 23rd, 1990 in LaGrange, Illinois, and the interviewer is Gene Krasno. Well, this is an interview with Larry Finkelstein, and for the record, I would just like to ask you to explain what your role was during the conference in San Francisco in 1945 for the founding of the United Nations.
Well, that's easy to do. I had been in the Office of Special Political Affairs in the State Department, which was the office responsible for preparing for the drafting of the UN Charter and the conference in San Francisco. And I'd been there at first as an intern, starting in July 1944. Mm-hmm. And then I guess I was hired as a junior professional person early in 1945, mm-hmm. something like that. And my work had been primarily concerned with the non-self-governing territories of the UN Charter. And I worked in what was called the Division of Dependent Area Affairs in the Office of Special Political Affairs. And there I had worked with under Benjamin Garrig, who was the chief of the division and mm-hmm. was also a figure in the American delegation at the conference, Ralph Bunch, who at some time became the associate chief of the division, that may have been later, mm-hmm. but he had moved over from the Office of Strategic Services shortly before I joined as an intern in the middle of 1944. Mm-hmm. I've worked with James Frederick Green, who is the man whose picture is shown with President Truman on the platform when Truman gave his final address and I guess signed the UN Charter for the United Nations at the end of the conference. Thomas F. Power was a member of that staff. He went on to a career in the United Nations and died a couple of years ago. Elizabeth Armstrong is another person who was in that group. She's long dead. Emil Sadie came along perhaps a little later after the conference. He became a State Department professional working on non-self-governing territories, and I guess he worked in the UN later also. Mm-hmm. So that was the context, and I was delighted to be given what seemed to me a real break of being allowed to go to the San Francisco conference.
Yeah.
Where I was assigned to what was called the correspondence unit, three or four supernumeraries who were there to answer the mail received by the delegation, which was quite voluminous, and we did it by categorizing incoming letters and sending out form responses for the most part. But then, at the middle of the conference, the more senior people who had had the responsibility of preparing the minutes of the U.S. delegation meetings were overburdened with other responsibilities. Mm-hmm. Those two people were Dorothy Fosdick and Ralph Bunn.
Oh,
and so I was asked to replace them, mm-hmm. which I did for the second half of the conference, beginning sometime around the middle of May until the end of June. Mm-hmm. And that involved sitting in the back of the room when the delegation met. Mm-hmm. Ordinarily, once a day, 5 days a week, or sometimes six. Occasionally, two meetings in one day. Mm-hmm. And I had to prepare two sets of minutes, one a synopsis, a very short, no more than two-page summary, mm-hmm. and the other as complete a record as I could make, as verbatim as possible. And I would go back to the office, which we had. It really wasn't much of an office. It was the gold room of the Fairmont Hotel, a great big cavernous space with desks and lots of people doing a variety of tasks there. And I had a string of secretaries who were recruited locally, who were quite good, and I would wear them out and myself dictating these extensive minutes.
Yeah.
And all of this had to be done by the next morning.
Right.
And as you can imagine, for a youth like myself, that was a formidable experience and quite a wondrous one.
Yeah.
There were significant people in the room comprising the delegation and the senior advisors to the delegation. There were significant issues being discussed, and I was there as a fly on the wall, and although it was a pittance, I was being paid to do it. It could have been better.
Well, how were the delegations composed there, and then how were the committees set up?
Well, I just happened recently to be looking at Alger Hiss's recent book, and he reminded me that the delegation was essentially constructed by President Roosevelt before he died. And as nearly as I can tell from that, the State Department recommended the composition of the delegation to President Roosevelt, who accepted their proposal, and with one exception, I don't want to be misinterpreted on that, he didn't turn them down on any, but there was one member of the delegation who apparently was not on that list and who turned up as a delegation member later, and I'm not sure how that happened.
Oh, who was that?
Well, that was Harold Stassen.
All right.
But the original list proposed to the president, according to his, consisted of the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who was a Democrat, Senator Tom Connally, his Republican opposite number, the senior Republican member, Arthur Vandenberg, and a potential presidential candidate, it was thought at the time. Their equivalents from the House Foreign Affairs Committee, Congressman Sol Bloom of New York and Congressman Charles Eaton of New Jersey. Edward Stettinius was the chairman of the delegation, although nominally the Secretary of the State was the chairman. The Secretary of State was the chairman, Cordell Hull, but he was ill and he couldn't come. So
right,
the actual
so Hull
chairman
was not in San Francisco.
Hull was not in San Francisco ever during the conference.
And what was Stettinius's position in the U.S. government?
He was Undersecretary.
He was Undersecretary, all right.
And he succeeded to become Secretary.
And he became Secretary of State after that,
Is that correct? I'm a little confused as to the time. I think he probably was Secretary of State at the time. He had been Undersecretary at the time he was nominated, perhaps, by the professional.
But Hull was quite
ill. But he was
Secretary.
One would have to check.
Yeah, it was a transition period.
And he was replaced shortly after the conference by James Burns, who was Truman's opponent. But I think he was Secretary during this time. Virginia Gildersleeve, former dean of Barnard College, maybe still at that time dean, was the one woman on the delegation. And then subsequently, somehow or other, Harold Stassen materialized and became a member of the delegation. He had been governor of Minnesota. He was a liberal Republican. He was in the Pacific as an assistant to Admiral Halsey in the Pacific Naval Campaign. He was quite an impressive fellow.
Now, I understand the present Senator Claiborne Pell was also in San Francisco. Do you recall what his role was?
It's interesting. Thank you for reminding me. He, I guess, was in the Navy.
I think he was actually in the Coast Guard.
And I believe, but this would have to be checked and could easily be done so on the record, I believe that he was a junior member of the staff of a sister division to mine in the Department of State, the Division of International Security Affairs. That's my best guess, because he did spend some time working there. And the head of that division was Joseph Johnson, who later became president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, where he hired me, and he was my boss for a number of years. He died just a few weeks ago. Another person who was there, who was in naval uniform, because I remember meeting him on the train, the special train from the East Coast to San Francisco, was Bernard Brody, who was a lieutenant in the Navy. And Bernard was I hadn't heard of him before, but he later became known as an outstanding scholar of national security affairs and a leading figure in the Yale Institute of International Affairs, and then I guess he must have moved down to Princeton with the others. And he was at the Rand Corporation. So it's good to note that he was there. One thing that probably has come up before, but which is worth mentioning, is that that conference involved a considerable innovation in conference procedure, because the U.S. delegation took the initiative in creating a category of participants who were consultants to the delegation.
Oh, I see.
And these were people who represented major non-governmental organizations in the United States.
Okay, right.
Including the big trade unions, the CIO and the AFL at the time, the major lay religious organizations, B'nai B'rith, and the Conference of Church, the National Conference of Churches of Christ in America, etc., and the NAACP was among them. And those organizations are all listed in an appendix to the official report of the U.S. delegation to the president after the conference was over. There was such an official conference report. I have a copy of it upstairs.
And where would that official conference report be located? What kind of...
Well, I would think any body. Library should have it.
Uh-huh.
I've held on to my original copy, which I carried from San Francisco with me. But it's an official document of the delegation to the president, not to be in the papers of the executive office.
Okay.
And
right.
As I say, any good line will tell. It's a public document.
All right.
What else should I say about this? The conference had a secretariat.
Right, right. And there were a number of Americans in the secretariat.
I think this would have to be checked, but I think the secretariat was exclusively, but certainly predominantly American.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And the Secretary General was Alger Hiss.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And he was supposed to be there in an international capacity as the servant of the entire conference and not in his capacity as a U.S. government official because he was not a member of the American delegation.
Right, right.
Then there was, of course, as is traditional in conferences of this kind, there was a plenary meeting. That is a big meeting of all the delegations, which was the, if you will, the sovereign body of the conference. And it was that body which took the final vote at the end, approving the charter which had been drafted.
Right.
And then, for working purposes, the conference was broken up into four commissions, known by their Roman numerals 1 through 4.
Okay.
And each of those commissions had two or more committees, known by their Arabic numbers 1, 2, 3, whatever.
Okay.
And for example, the trusteeship, I forget what it was called, it was probably called the Committee on Trusteeship and Non-Self-Governing Territories or something like that, was Commission 2, Committee 4.
I see, okay.
And the one that dealt with questions like the veto and the workings of the UN Security Council was Commission 3, Committee 3.
Oh, okay. So then the delegates from the various countries might be represented on various different committees. They would be a mixture of them.
These are full membership bodies, so every participating government was entitled to participate in every one of those committees. And sometimes, of course, when the going got rough or the work got heavy or particular tasks had to be accomplished, the committees broke off into subcommittees or working parties, which were smaller. They would pull in the participants whose presence was necessary to get the job done, or whose interests were at stake. So it was a very large, quite cumbersome, and very complex business.
Right.
And then there was also a body, there were several small expert kinds of bodies which had to do some of the mechanical work of the conference. And I can't reproduce them all from memory. I haven't thought about this in a long time. But one that was particularly important was called the Coordination Committee.
Okay.
And this was a small body in which technical experts, high-level technical experts from the five great powers present, participated. And I forget whether there were others also in that committee. And theirs was the task of weaving together and technically correcting and amending and making perfect the texts that emerged for the various segments of the charter out mm-hmm. of this committee process.
Okay.
And theirs was the task of reconciling the incompatibilities that emerged from this process in which different committees dealt with different problems in different parts of the charter.
Yeah, right.
The American on that was Leo Pazwalski.
Right, okay.
Who had mm-hmm. been the special assistant to the Secretary of State for this whole process
mm-hmm.
and was the highest ranking permanent continuing official of the Department of State
mm-hmm.
For these matters, and to whom my section and division, for example, reported in the State Department.
Okay.
So he was the top man in the process, and he did the... He represented the United States in that coordination.
Right.
He had a great influence.
And the Soviet that participated in that committee, was that Sobolev?
Could have been. I don't remember. It's uh-huh. The record is available. Mm-hmm. It's easy to check on things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know that after the conference, a series of volumes were published recording the conference.
Okay.
They were called the UNIO documents, the United Nations Information Office.
Okay.
And I think there are 14 volumes on the San Francisco conference.
Mm-hmm.
And in that you would find all the information about the structure of the conference and who were the participants.
Uh-huh.
But to tell you the truth, I'm not sure whether the Russian was Sobolev or their principal legal advisor, Golunsky. I just don't know.
Okay, yeah. As long as we're talking about some of the people who were involved there, we'll get back to some of the other things. There were some other people, like Nelson Rockefeller, who was also there. And what was his role?
Nelson Rockefeller was, at that time, I think he was coordinator of Inter-American Affairs.
Okay.
Which was a body created during the war to perform a sort of an antecedent to the American aid program.
Mm-hmm.
And he had run a vigorous program of American assistance in Latin America. Although I think he was not yet Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs, although mm-hmm. at some point he did become that.
Mm-hmm.
So he was there as an official of the government
mm-hmm.
Who was an advisor to the delegation.
An advisor to the delegation, okay.
And a very active one.
Yeah. Yeah.
And again, now that you mention it, I was a little surprised reading Hiss's book the other day to learn something I hadn't known. An issue that arose was the status of Argentina.
Right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which had not declared war against the Axis.
Yeah.
And consequently, as a result of the decision reached in the Yalta Conference, should not have been eligible to be a member of the San Francisco Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And Hiss's story is that he said the whole American delegation were astonished when a group of Latin American countries took the floor in the plenary meeting, one of the early plenary meetings, to propose that Argentina be invited to participate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the circumstances that could not be prevented, and Argentina was invited to join the conference,
mm-hmm.
the speculation was that this had been engineered by Nelson Rockefeller working on his own, not as a matter of U.S. government policy,
mm-hmm.
with the Latin Americans, contrary to the commitment made by President Roosevelt to Stalin at Yalta.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the American delegation was extremely embarrassed about this, but sort of got preempted by this ploy in which Nelson Rockefeller was involved.
Yeah.
I know that he... this happened early in the conference, long before I was involved in taking the minutes, so mm-hmm. I have no first-hand knowledge of any kind.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that later on, he was a very vigorous advocate of the interests of a of a special view of the American interest vis-a-vis the Latinos, which mm-hmm. had him confronting the Secretary of State, who was the head of the delegation, head on. I once saw them jaw to jaw in the penthouse room, which was part of Stettinius's suite, mm-hmm. and where the delegation sometimes met. Uh-huh.
Do you recall what the issue was that they were discussing at that
no,
point?
No, I was far enough away so I couldn't hear what they were talking about, but I could read the body language,
and those two were
disagreeing with each other.
Yeah.
And at that time, the issue had arisen about the Latin American wish to emphasize regional over global machinery, mm-hmm, particularly mm-hmm. for handling issues of peace and security. Mm-hmm. If we have a minute, there's an interesting tale here, because...
Yeah, the role of regional organizations versus the role of a global organization.
And that's an issue that has plagued the organization throughout mm-hmm. its history.
Yeah.
But what had happened was that going back to President Roosevelt and Secretary Hull, they had taken initiatives through a series of inter-American conferences in the 1930s, which had produced what was known as the Era of Good Feeling mm-hmm. Between the Latinos and the United States. The collaboration during the war had been mutually beneficial and very effective, mm-hmm. with the main exception of Argentina.
Right.
And as a consequence, at the end of the war, the Latinos were quite comfortable with the United States and very uneasy about the role of the Soviet Union as a communist state in the UN. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they were troubled by the emphasis of the US policy of placing the primary responsibility for peacekeeping in the UN Security Council, mm-hmm. where the Latinos were afraid Latin American issues of peace and security might encounter a veto from this so communist, non-Catholic, anti-religious Soviet Union. So at that time, 1945, the Latinos were much more comfortable sharing the inter-American bed with the United States than the global bed with the Soviet Union.
I see.
And so they
okay.
were pushing
okay.
very hard for exceptions to the globalist orientation of the charter.
Okay, that's an interesting interpretation of why.
Oh, I'm sure.
Issue came up. Yeah.
I'm sure I'm right.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
In that general
right.
presentation of the game, uh-huh. and the issues. It reads rather strange in the light of the later deterioration of relations between the United States and uh-huh. the Latinos as a whole. Uh-huh. After some time in the mid-50s. Relationship began to change for the worse, mm-hmm. and it would be hard for, it's still hard for me to believe that things were so comfortable in 1945 to produce mm-hmm. that Latin pressure on the United States to adulterate the global principle of the time. Mm-hmm.
So
I suspect that Nelson Rockefeller was advocating that point of view uh-huh. against the universalist tendency of
right.
the Secretary of State, who was in any case quite uncertain about it. But Leo Pazvalsky, I think the president, two presidents, Roosevelt and uh-huh. Truman had come to that meeting.
So the Latin Americans' point of view was that they would prefer that matters of dispute or threats to the peace be handled regionally before the United Nations
They certainly wanted to have that option preserved. Mm-hmm. And this pressure from the Latinos was one of the factors that entered into the adoption of that article in the Charter, Article 51, which preserves the right of individual and collective self-defense. And they also were pressing on the provision which found its way into the Article 53, I believe it was. I have a copy right here that I'm trying to check in. I'm sorry to take this much time.
Oh, that's fine. This is what
Article
we're here for.
Article 52 has to do with regional arrangements, and Article 53 also. Mm-hmm. And I remember vividly that the first day I began to take minutes mm-hmm. in the delegation meeting, one of the issues was one which had been on the agenda before and stayed on the delegation's agenda for some time mm-hmm. after the day of which I speak. Mm-hmm. And it had to do with the question whether in Article 53, toward the end of the first paragraph, the word should be on the request of the governments concerned, mm-hmm. or, I forget what the alternative was, with the acquiescence or something like that of the governments concerned, having to do with the transition from regional authority to deal with enforcement action when there were threats to the peace, to the taking over of responsibility by the UN. Mm-hmm. And the Latinos wanted the word request because it left the initiative with mm-hmm. them.
Right.
And the alternative would have left the initiative with the members of the Security Council. Mm-hmm. And the difference was not obviously a terribly great one, but it really roiled the conference and occupied 20 minutes or so of the delegation's time for mm-hmm. many mornings. Mm-hmm. And all of this is part of that mm-hmm. that issue having to do with the Latinos' preference for certainty mm-hmm. that peace and security matters in the hemisphere could be dealt with by the Inter-American system,
right.
then the Pan-American Union, uh-huh. later to become the Organization of American States,
right.
rather than to risk the uncertain fate mm-hmm. that would be theirs in the UN Security Council.
Right. So there was a concern for the language that went into the charter to keep it clear that the points were being made correctly, that the sources of power were designated specifically. Was there an effort to make the language flexible also?
No. Well, I shouldn't say no. You know, this example is one of a word carrying a very heavy substantive mm-hmm. burden.
Right.
It was an issue mm-hmm. of disagreement among states for which the word was intended to be dissolving. And that's why it was so bitterly contested and mm-hmm. consumed so much time mm-hmm. over so many meetings and so extended a period in the conference. That sort of issue didn't often arise.
Okay.
But because, you know, by and large, the conference had the benefit of a draft of the charter, which had been prepared by the great powers meeting the previous summer mm-hmm. in the Dumbarton Oaks conversations,
right.
where most of the issues about the structure and the main powers and directions of the organization had been, to all intents and purposes, settled. So mm-hmm. they had this draft charter laid before them mm-hmm. at the beginning of the conference in San Francisco, and that stood up very well. Because, among other reasons, the great powers, the United States, Soviet Union, England, France, and China, were determined to maintain their cohesion and thus were unwilling to risk opening up what they had done to a serious amendment mm-hmm. by outside pressure.
Right.
So that much of it was pretty well set, and a great deal of what went on was examination of what the great powers draft meant, what its implications were. The alterations, the amendments, tended to be relatively marginal mm-hmm. to the main agreements that had already been reached.
Right.
Now, in some cases, that was not true, and one of the issues was the extent to which the veto was to apply.
Right. I think we need to just stop and turn this over.